FM and Capital Digital, the time is 6 o'clock.
Presents The Listening Post, a program of information and entertainment, especially for those with Defence Force associations, past and present, first responders, and their families and friends. Welcome to The Listening Post. I'm your host, Tony Howes. Alan Downes is our research officer and Nigel Rogers, the resident military historian. My studio colleague is Susan, and our telephone number is 9364 9888. The discussion topic for this program is the Royal Australian Navy, looking back and looking forward. Such matters as AUKUS and what it means, how has past naval history affected plans for the future? And what is the need, if any, for change in structure and naval training? Are all part of the discussions this evening. Joining our resident military historian and president of the WA chapter of the Naval Historical Association, Nigel Rogers, is Commodore Brett Dowsing, formerly Senior Officer, Western Australia, and a former warden of the WA State War Memorial, with 51 years service in the Royal Australian Navy, including time spent with sea commands and shore postings in Washington, Mongolia, and Australian Chief Liaison Officer, United Nations Command, Korea. Commodore Dowsing also served in Vietnam. So, to our discussion subject, the Royal Australian Navy. And that's why from the Listening Post bandstand we hear the central band of the Royal Australian Navy with the march called The New Colonial.
Thank you.
Welcome this evening to a slightly different The Listening Post, coming to you from Capital Radio. Slightly different in that it's more a discussion than it is an interview. And if you don't hear much from me, it's because I'm becoming involved and just listening. But in any case, in the studio at the moment are two people, Commodore Brett Dowsing and Nigel Rogers. Now, you know Nigel. He lives in the cabinet over by the window there, and we bring him out as our historian, resident historian. But Commodore Brett Dowsing is somebody who's flown in the air, sailed on the sea, sailed under the sea. What else have you done, Brett Dowsing?
Well, I've been just a normal, typical Navy guy for 50 years, Tony. just at sea, like you say, but also ashore, and been fortunate enough to spend quite a significant proportion of my career overseas.
Yes, indeed. We're not going to go into great histories,
no.
but I would like to say, ask you, and I think I know the answer from an interview we've done before, what is the most significant overseas posting that you had?
I think I'd have to say during 9/11 in Washington, D.C., observing
yes.
what went on from an American perspective and an Allied perspective over the intervening period immediately before and then immediately after 9/11.
And very, very simple question, probably with a very complicated answer. Was there a difference in the reactions from the Australian personnel with you at the embassy and around it and the Americans?
Yeah, I think there was. I think we went through similar sorts of experiences, obviously, the initial anxiety, et cetera, and the reactions to the actual terror of the buildings coming down, being struck, of course, first and then coming down. But I think for the Americans, it was, you know, this was a significant attack on their land.
Yes.
And that hadn't occurred for, you know, since the War of Independence,
yes.
really, or Pearl Harbor, I guess.
Yeah. And, of course, you had our Prime Minister in the country.
We did.
Right there.
Yeah. John Howard was certainly there, and I think that changed to a large extent exactly Australia's reaction, being on the ground, seeing it, experiencing it himself, being with the leaders immediately after it occurred, making certain commitments of involvement and support. It was a fascinating period of Allied cooperation.
Are you writing a book ever?
I'm writing stories, but
yeah.
Whether they turn out to be a book or not, I'm not sure. It's not really about the book. It's about for the family more than anything.
Yes, fair enough.
Mm.
Okay, now to our other guest, Nigel. Where were you when 9/11 happened?
That's an interesting question, Tony. I was actually supposed to go to Tokyo on business, and kind of long story short, I never went. So instead, I had to go on business to Milan for Citibank that I worked with, and I was carrying out a review of the business, Citibank's business in Milan. And I still remember very vividly when 9/11 happened, because I was talking to some traders on the trading floor of the bank in Milan. And all the Reuters screens were on, and suddenly the screens were full of planes going into the tower, and we all just stopped. Traders all stopped, everything stopped, and we couldn't believe what we were seeing.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe what we were seeing.
It was, from your memories, and I'm pinning you down on something we haven't talked about before, did 9/11 make a big impact on trade and all the sort of business things that would normally happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the world it's never been the same since 9/11. If you think about international travel, everything changed after 9/11. You know, the security had to be ramped up big time. The biggest number of flights in the world, certainly for business people, is from Europe to the United States. That all literally ground to a halt. And then we went to a situation where security, you know, was seriously ramped up. And, you know, it had to happen, but it really has inconvenienced everybody's lives. It's never been the same travel since then.
Well, I don't know whether there is a link, but there is in my mind. We're talking tonight about our naval defences, past, present and in the future. So, thinking of 9/11 in the past, were we ready as a naval nation, an island isolated, ready or even have any of that thinking in us that something like this could happen, Brett?
Look, I think if you look at it from a historical perspective, the quick answer is probably not. I don't think anyone anticipated an attack of that type with the level of ramifications that immediately came from it. I would posture that we're never ready. And if an enemy is competent in any way, shape or form, we shouldn't be either.
Yes, yeah.
You know, the attack, the Pearl Harbor attack, is a prime example. Yeah. Did they know it was coming? They had inklings. Did they really know? Possibly. But look at the effects of that attack, one attack, you know, on the course of the war thereafter.
Nigel, the point that Brett's brought up, how different were the Americans' reactions historically to Pearl Harbor? Because before, if I'm right, the feeling in the Americas was, oh, we don't want anything to do with it. It's a European war, blah, blah, blah. Hitler, oh, yeah, we know about him. But Pearl Harbor changed that,
Well, it did, absolutely, because America was, at the time, very isolationist, very inward-looking. It had no real desire or interest to support Britain in its hour of need in Europe. And we know that, you know, Churchill was struggling to convince the United States and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, president, to come to the aid of Britain. And of course they did step up and they started you know, sending stuff on a land lease basis. You know, you have the famous quote, I think he said, we'll give you a hose to try and put out the fire. And that started land lease. So but it wasn't until Pearl Harbor that America finally changed its mind and focused their mind, thought, goodness me, you know, this is, we need to do something. And, you know, it was, that's when everything changed. The United States came into the war, and we know the power of the United States once it cranks up and starts making things, Liberty ships, etc., etc. The American Army Air Force made a massive difference, and this huge war in the Pacific that then took place that helped to relieve the pressure on Australia.
Brett, what, from your memory, I don't mean you were there, but from what you know of naval history and so on, what was our sort of naval defence like just before the Second World War? Was it intact at all?
I think it was, but it wasn't. Was it a fighting ready element of the Defence Force? Well, I suspect not. Quietly, not until very close to the commitments. We did commit to Europe first, of course, and then once the Japanese had entered the war through the Pearl Harbor attack, and that we ended up bringing a lot of our war fighting capabilities back into the Pacific arena, and most of that had been exposed pretty well over the couple of years, 39 to 41. Through, you know, Mediterranean ops, a lot of our folks had been working in the Royal Australian, the Royal Air Force, and the Royal Navy. There were commitments to it. So, and of course, we had the 8th Brigade Division, that was in North Africa.
Yes,
you know, so we did have exposure afterwards, but say pre 39, going into the war. I think we were grasping and working up to it fairly quickly, but you don't get these capabilities overnight.
No. Would it be true, and this is for either of you, would it be true to say that the whole sort of world situation at that time was the defence of anything really depended on a naval force rather than anything else?
Yeah, I would just comment as follows, and you know, obviously Brett will, you know, want to chime in here, but mm-hmm. I think there was an over-reliance in the 20s and 30s on the Royal Navy, and principally on the base at Singapore, which Australia and New Zealand signed up to, and it was really the kind of key focus for defence in our region. And it was called the Singapore Strategy, and the plan was that if anybody showed any aggressive intent towards Australia, the British colonies, Hong Kong, the Royal Navy would be dispatched from the UK and would, you know, see the enemy off. And of course, at the time, the threat was seen as Japan, which was expanding into China and had its wishes to expand into other areas. And Singapore, of course, was a key place for them to take in order to control the region. And, of course, Singapore fell very quickly because nobody expected the Japanese army to come down the Malay Peninsula. Mm. Nobody thought they could get through it. And the guns were all pointing out to sea. We all know the story, because they thought the attack would come from the sea. And the Navy was sent, Force Z, and very sadly, the Repulse and the Prince of Wales were sunk very quickly by Japanese bombers operating from the mainland. The first capital ships to be lost by bombing, albeit from the land. And, you know, Singapore collapsed. And then Australia really looked then to the United States for its future defence. And certainly Australia was on its own. Britain was in trouble.
The Listening Post, bringing you Looking Back and Looking Forward, the Royal Australian Navy. Now, Commodore Dowsing, a question.
What sort of ships did we actually have, say, prior to the fall of Singapore? Well, then, you know, what sorts were they?
Are you talking about Australian ships?
Yeah, Australian ships.
Mostly very small cruisers, light cruisers, one or two heavy cruisers and destroyers and torpedo boats, basically. Very lightweight, a couple of ancillary vessels as well. But if I could, going back to the question before, Tony, about and it's only out of this discussion that I'm thinking about it, from a strategic point of view, I wonder what would have happened if the Japanese had advanced down through Asia and Southeast Asia without attacking Pearl Harbor. Would that have drawn the Americans in its own right in taking Singapore? Yeah. I suspect not.
Yes.
I suspect not. But, you know, actually attacking the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, and I understand the reasons behind it, but strategically, would it not have been smarter? Because, you know, when you think about it, they were in Manchuria and in China. They'd already invaded those sort of places, Korea, over the periods well and truly earlier from the war perspective. So if they'd advanced down that coast and come in through and taken Singapore, I just wonder whether, you know, what that might have meant.
I think, too, and I don't want to jump ahead too far to to the present yet, but that also rings a bell in my mind that some of the things that are happening today may well be better served by answering that question of what are the alternatives in the attack plan of a so-called enemy, rather than this is what they appear to be doing.
Yes.
I know that's a bit of a woofly type of statement.
But I agree, you know, because essentially if you look at what Australia's reaction was, and I'm a child of a few years living in a place called Rabaul in Papua New Guinea, which was ended up being the major Japanese base of Southeast Asia. When I sit back and I look at what might have been, at that time, we Australia had only put forward very small garrisons, across the archipelago, pelagic states to the north of us, and so had we really thought it through in terms of what would Japanese aspirations actually have been and what could have happened. And I sort of, in some ways, comes back to your point there, trying to think around to the broader strategic aspirations of a potential enemy rather than just picking one. Yes. And I think, that draws in possibly your original postulation about, failures early on, in our strategic determinations.
It's a thinking failure.
Coming back to Brent's point, though, a very interesting thought, if they hadn't attacked Pearl Harbor and just come down and taken Singapore. But I think it's important to remember that another reason why Japan came into the war is that it was heavily blockaded, and the main leader of that was the United States. Japan has no natural resources, nothing in the ground, no oil, it imports everything, although despite the fact it's now the third most successful economy in the world. So it was being bled of any natural resources, oil, etc., and that's why they looked to these regions, China and indeed what is now Indonesia, the base at Singapore, because they wanted to get their hands on oil. So the United States and Britain and other allies, the Dutch, actually were blockading Japan, and that forced the hand of the Japanese. I think that's forgotten sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're right, and but I still come back to it. If Japan had come right the way through and ultimately had got the oil fields of Dutch East Indies, which is probably their major aspiration.
That's what it was about.
Again, America, it was obviously a threat, and that it was perceived as a threat to that aspiration, basically being in the Philippines and also Pearl Harbor and a few other dotted islands through the Pacific. But it does, you know, it does bring that question out. Did they think of that? Was it, you know, what was their thought processes and their calculation as to whether that would draw America in or not? And I think that's where we, in the modern world, you know, spend a lot of time trying to think those things out. Sometimes we figure it out too much.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. Well, before we leave the past, what are there for the big lessons for the present, not the future, we're going to go there soon, but for the ensuing present after the Second World War? What were the naval lessons learned from the Second World War?
I think we touched on it earlier on, and that is that you have to be prepared. And the second part of it, being prepared, is two aspects to it. One is your fighting one's your fighting force, and the fighting force are ships and men, and other capabilities that would fight with them. You know, I don't underestimate the certainly the air power aspect of things if you're fighting a maritime war. That's the first part of it. The second part is the support and the sustainability of it. And I think that we thought about it, but I don't think we actually executed anything of great rate. And in a lot of ways, you can understand it, having come out of 6 years of warfare. The people that were there were ready to turn their back on warfare quietly.
Let's have a holiday.
Let's return to a normal lifetime.
Having said all that, I think many historians and people far wiser than me have said that actually the Navy, both the Australian Navy, the Royal Australian Navy, the Royal Navy and Allied forces, the most successful fighting force was the Navy. Very effective. Despite all the challenges that it faced, many people agree that the Navy actually performed about the best, despite some equipment. I mean, there's the famous comment by Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda, who described the Australian contribution as a scrap iron fleet. And they were all ex-First World War ships that were operating in the Mediterranean and were very successful. But Goebbels sort of, you know, wrote it off as a scrap iron fleet, but they did a damn fine job. And many battles were won by the Royal Australian Navy working with the Royal Navy. So there were huge success stories of the Navy.
Talking of success stories, and this is, I'm asking both of you whether this is a success story or indicates one. There are lots of, I think, wonderful stories about Fremantle and the submarines. Were they an effective part of that success?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, look, you'd have to say that. Of course, you had to come back to maybe the more pessimistic view at times. There were also some serious tragedies, as you well recall, from the prisoner of war ships and that side of it being sunk by submarines operating from here. But as a strategic deterrent and a strategic fighting force side of the house, it was absolutely,
absolutely
a major aspect of our success in the Second World War. Japan just couldn't keep up with those lines of communication that it had set up early on in the piece, right down into the Dutch East Indies and New Guinea at the time, trying to maintain those supply lines and that. And the Americans and the strategy of beating them, going around to a large extent and isolating, was incredibly successful.
Yeah, I mean,
submarines were a major part of that.
Fremantle was the second biggest submarine base in the Pacific, in our region, behind Pearl Harbor. It was huge. I mean, absolutely massive.
And to finish this section on a positive note, there have been lots you've shared with us. I also think of that wonderful story of the slipping into Singapore and blowing up
the crate.
Yes.
Commando operations.
Well, that's, you know, half a dozen to a dozen men on a tiny boat, we weren't talking aircraft carriers,
But coming back to Fremantle, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it was a very large number, something like over 50%, probably nearer 60% of Japanese a tonnage that was sunk were by submarines out of Fremantle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the contribution was huge. Yeah.
Yes, yes, indeed.
In fact, over the war era, it was over 160 submarines that actually operated out of Fremantle, upwards of a maximum of 50 at any one time. You know, and that's the American, the British.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. People don't understand it, and you know, it was. It's always been interesting to me to talk to people that actually lived through that period in Perth and Fremantle. My mother being one of them, who once famously said to me, "You're damn lucky you're not speaking with an American accent, boy."
we won't go there, Bruce.
And on that note,
talking of notes, I think we'll have some music. Then we'll be back after the music to, I think, continue on into the present, which will eventually lead us to the future. The station is Capital Radio 101.7 FM and Capital Digital, and the program is The Listening Post tonight, talking with Commodore Brett Dansing and Nigel Rogers about things watery and war. How did you like that? Watery and war, Brett?
The two W's. Put Wonka on it as well.
As long as you pronounce it properly.
Correct. Yes, indeed.
Okay. Gentlemen, we were about to encroach into the present, but do feel free to refer back to anything that affects that statement. With the Navy, I'm not talking about any plans for the future just yet, but what is the situation? How many ships have we now got? Are they the right ones at present for what is needed? Brett?
Yeah, look, I think the present day still sort of revolves around a defence policy of defence in depth and a balanced defence force. So they're the sort of words that have been used from a policy and doctrinal point of view. So what makes up the Navy at the moment is reasonably capable. I would use the word reasonably. Mm. It is aligned much more to trying to cover, and when we come and talk about defence in depth, you're talking open ocean, you're talking littoral, mm. you're talking brown water and green water, if mm. you like, rather than blue water. Blue water being deep ocean type capabilities. Yes. So you're trying to cover that span, if you like, yeah. from a defence and a warfighting perspective. I'm a naval aviator by background. The only thing missing, as far as I'm concerned, are aircraft carriers. But we've got a couple of those even that are not masquerading, but they're much more aligned to troop insertion and that side of the warfare domain. We have rather. And this is something that happens across navies. The names and the classes of ships do change over time.
Yes.
You know, we call our largest surface warfighting ships destroyers now. Mm. Destroyers, they would have been light cruisers. The firepower side of the house would have been, you know, a light battleship, basically, if you want to transfer back in time.
Yeah, so, which would give you a clear understanding, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you're working from destroyers. Frigates are probably the major working unit of the Royal Australian Navy at the moment. They're a MECO German design, which has been modified hugely over the last 20-odd years, last 20-odd years of its life, down to, you know, offshore patrol vessels now. Mm. And we call them offshore patrol vessels. We would have called them corvettes in the old days, down to patrol boats. And patrol boats are patrol boats, yes, essentially. But if you look across the Navy at the moment, I should have mentioned the submarine force, of course. Mm. Our Collins-class submarines, the six of them at the moment, and the aviation, the helicopter side, the fleet air arm mm. side of the house as well. I should have mentioned that as well. But so that forms the Royal Australian Navy in its current form. I think the major challenge has always been, and it really does go back into history as well as going forward and looking at it, you're trying to develop up a firepower. And Australia is responsible for almost one-tenth of the world's water surface area. More than one-tenth.
Yeah, tiny little nation in the sense of people.
Yeah, exactly. Mm, yeah. Tiny little nation, huge landmass, and even huge, you know, almost double the size of the landmass in water mass that we're sort of basically judicially responsible for.
Yeah.
From a tactical point of view, of course, we go back to the islands of the north, we go to the Pacific, and we go to the Indian Ocean, and the sea lines of communication that we rely on at the moment in terms of, you know, import, export and value.
Look, we can't talk about the present without talking about the future.
Mm.
I've, you know, come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
That when we talk about what's now, it obviously calls into question of what we think are going to extend the now into something more positive than is currently available. So to both of you, the question there is, if we're looking towards China, if we're looking towards keeping the trade avenues open, are we capable at the moment, or are things needed for the future?
Can I just step in here? I think an important point, and just as Brett said, the Collins-class submarines, they're going through something at the moment that I think the Navy refers to as life of time extension, LOTE.
Mm.
And that means that the Collins-class were coming towards the end of their life, but they are being extended in order to fill the gap before AUKUS fully comes on stream. And there's a huge amount of work being done at the moment here in Western Australia, and also with Kockums of Sweden, the original designers of the submarine, to give a further length of life to the Collins-class submarines, which are vitally important for the defence of Australia, particularly in our region. They are all based out of Stirling here in Western Australia at Perth. So this is a very important project that's in train at the moment.
Well, okay, look, can I be specific about what you've just introduced? In fact, do the personnel that make up the current people who can drive those submarines, will they be the same skills required for the nuclear subs or not?
To a large extent, yes.
So those people will be transferable.
Depends on age. And that's the time, and it also depends on having enough that are already sort of prepared to build. And remember, we're going from a 60-man submarine to a 100-plus-man submarine,
yes.
And that's going to be a big part of it. But there are different aspects to these submarines. Quiet conventional is what we call, the Collins class.
Yes.
They're relatively slow, but they've got great legs, i.e. they've got great range, and they can operate very quietly in relatively shallow water and do certain tasks that nuclear submarines, who have a high speed, incredible endurance, only limited by the manpower, really, and the food and the aspects of supporting those men and women in the submarines. So you've got a very different thing. They basically do. There are similar jobs that they can both do, but they are highly specialist in one, either the left or right of arc of what a submarine can do.
Is this why we're seeing the real PR push for personnel to sign up?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, the submarine force will almost, it will have to over double what the current capabilities are. You're increasing your numbers out to 8-odd boats. You have to get a very specialist group in terms of the engineering side, which is the nuclear power aspects of it. But the operation of the boat itself, it is different. I'm not a submariner, and I've got to emphasise that, but it is different in terms of it is very high speed, it is very deep diving, and it can reposition itself for attack very quickly in many different aspects.
Are we doing the right thing with AUKUS? Is it the good thing for Australia?
I think yes is the quick answer, and I take AUKUS being more than just the submarine component.
Please,
of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Look, it brings in a level of alignment that over my career time is probably the highest level of shared information, if you like, in certain aspects. And that's not just in equipments, that's in other aspects such as intelligence,
yes,
developmental work, going into the future, robotics.
In fact, Brent, is that not what we were talking about with having an alternative view, bringing that to fruition?
Absolutely.
With what we're trying to do now.
Yeah.
Well, that is reassuring as long as it continues.
Yeah, and it will. I have no doubt of its continuance at all. The level of commitment at the highest levels of UK, Australia and the US is just enormous. I don't see any reversal on that in any way, shape or form. The more interesting aspect from my perspective is, will we extend AUKUS out to others? In my humble opinion, Japan, Korea, most especially in our part of the world, not so much New Zealand, I hasten to add, will it bring those into the equation at a much closer level?
I think you're absolutely right, Brett, and there is already speculation about that, extending AUKUS to Japan. Who we will see. Watch this space, as they say. But I agree and I support Brett. I think the direction towards AUKUS is absolutely the right one for Australia. And to re-emphasise what Brett has said, it's not just about the submarines. And I know, quote from some of the... all this stuff's in the public domain. It's also about advanced military capabilities on artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, cyber warfare, undersea, hypersonic and counter-hypersonic electronic warfare. So there's a huge amount of advanced technology going to be part of the AUKUS program. It's not just about the submarines. There's a lot of other things that are going to happen, including stations, the first ones coming on stream here in Australia, I think in 2024, looking at space, what's going on in space. There's going to be a whole setup here, the UK, Australia, and the United States. And the first additional listening base for what is going on in space will be here in Western Australia.
I'm optimistic in terms that the Navy will always perform and rise to the occasion, but it won't be able to do it in absolute isolation. It will be highly dependent on interoperability with our allies, and that would be, you know, obviously the names are USA and UK, but increasingly so, India, Korea, China, Japan.
Yep.
You know, so I think that's where the real capability is going. We will have to contribute a component. I don't think we will ever have the capability wholly and solely within our own sovereign capability to do the job totally and absolutely.
So the sense of diplomatic, political and community sense of trust is also something that's got to be worked on absolutely. To make that happen.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely right. Absolutely.
I completely concur with what Brett has said. This is, I think, AUKUS, you might see an extension of it, as I think Brett has already touched on with Japan. We will see. And Brett's absolutely right. We can't do this on its own. That's what the power of AUKUS is about, working with others, principally, as Brett has said, the United States and Britain, but with other partners, and as you say, India will be one of the great countries into the future. It's already on its way, so we have to work with these countries in the region from a security point. And Japan will be very key as well.
And I think one of the really critical components of this, and we talk about it occasionally within the military circle, but I don't think we talk it widely enough outside of that circle to make it actually happen to the level it needs to, and that is interoperability. We've got to be able to operate with our allies totally and absolutely, which means coming back to your point before, Tony, about trust and capability, but we also need the supportability. And America, coming back to AUKUS, and especially, you know, we're already seeing one component of it peel out from pure research, but to share supportability and you know, doing the missile manufacture, etc., and that will occur, in my view. And I see the interoperability side, which, coming back to AUKUS, is an interesting one with the submarine. You know, I mean, ultimately, we should have exactly the same command systems, exactly the same warfare systems, exactly the same weaponry within the AUKUS vessels.
Nigel, thank you. Brett, thank you.
Thanks.
We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
A bit of work.
And it is a big thank you to Nigel and to Brett for being with us tonight. And now just let me go back on some of the music you heard during the discussion. Just then we just heard the MIDI, and of course all this is from the Royal Australian Central Band, Royal Australian Navy Central Band. It's the MIDI we heard then. Imperial Echoes was before that, and we had Old Faithful, right. This is the second one along, and the first one was the New Colonial, all marches coming to us from the Central Band of the Royal Australian Navy. Again, Brett and Nigel, wonderful, thank you. And you two will be returning next week, joined by Peter Fitzpatrick, to discuss the situation in Ukraine. And yes, that will be quite a discussion, I think, as we look at that, because unfortunately the coverage of it sort of dropped away with all the terrible things happening in the Middle East. But nonetheless, that's the topic of conversation, Ukraine, next week. But, well, hey, still on the bandstand with a little change. We are members of the Royal Australian Navy with something just a little bit different. Hey, not bad indeed. They were members of the Central Band there, the particular gift that they have to take us into a more jazz area, and that, of course, was Waltzing Matilda with the Central Band of the Royal Australian Navy, and they did us proud tonight from our bandstand, did they not? By the way, I tell you something that I must thoroughly recommend to you if it's at all possible, and that is to go and see, when it returns in its second season, because it's booked out at the moment, the wonderful production 21 Hearts by Theatre 180. That's the Vivian Bullwinkle and Nurses of the Viner Brook story. And I went to the opening night just recently at the refurbished Como Theatre, used to be called Signet. Quite outstanding in every way. And of course the atmosphere in that Como Theatre is great, because it has that sort of feel for heritage and so on, that our story of those 21 hearts, those 21 nurses who were massacred after the Viner Brook sinking. And Vivian, of course, being the one who was able, she was an incredibly brave lady who was able to fake that she was dead, and then later, of course, was interned in a POW camp and did so much to help the women there and rally the nurses that were there. Quite an exciting production. Jenny Davis has written the script, which is researched magnificently from the various sources that tell us that story, and the director was Stuart Hallis, giving a very sensitive production. It's not macabre or ghoulish in any way. Yes, you'll need a box of tissues when you go and see it. It's returning to the Como Theatre in November for an October-November season. So I suggest you keep an eye on your Google search and make sure you're there. Theatre 180 will give you all that news. But I don't always wax lyrical about everything I see, but this I certainly do, because it was most moving and very, very important story to have told in this way for us to sample the heritage given to us by those incredible nurses, and all they were able to stand, and some, of course, never returned. But Vivian did, and championed the cause of nurses for such a long time. Right, thanks to Susan for looking after me tonight, and our research officer Alan Downs OAM, and our technical producer Edo Brands. I say thank you very much to all those who've been putting together this program. Next week, the panel of Commodore Brett and Nigel, joined by Peter Patrick, to discuss a Ukraine. Alan Watson coming up next. So I'm sure Ted Zapara. Alan, I think, is tucked up in his bed at home. Ted Zapara coming up next. Sorry, Ted, with his wonderful program that I know everybody enjoys. And Saturday, I'll be back with Capital Events. So for the moment, though, it's Tony Howes wishing you well and saying good night and God bless to you all. Thank you for being with us on The Listening Post. Is Capital Radio 101.7 FM and Capital Digital, broadcasting to you from Perth in Western Australia, where the wonderful Ted Zapara is standing.